Our second case this morning is 2018-1831, State of Ohio versus Michael Smith. For the appellant, Ms. Gieske.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice O'Connor, Associate Justices, opposing counsel. May it please the court, Krista Gieske on behalf of Defendant Appellant Michael Smith. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Evidence of a person's character is not admissible to prove action in conformity. That's supposed to be the rule, at least. But the way that Ohio trial courts are applying the exceptions to the rule is swallowing the rule whole. Let's get back to trying someone on the conduct with which they are charged in the instant case. The cleanest way to do this is to bar evidence when it refers to a prior acquittal. Alternatively, or in addition, this court should refine the Williams test to require the following. One, that the proponent of the evidence identify the specific exceptions which it seeks to have the evidence admitted for. Two, that the trial court then assess the probative value for those proffered exceptions. Three, that then the court balances this probative value against the dangers of unfair prejudice. And four, if still deemed admissible, the trial court then instruct the jury in a tailored fashion as to those specific purposes. So 404B is one of the most confused and most often reversed issues in these cases. Here, this court attempted to provide guidance in the 2012 Williams case. And this case is evidence how the Williams test does not necessarily accomplish what the Williams court set out to do. This case presents an exciting opportunity for this court to revisit and clarify all three prongs of Williams in a manner that will tremendously benefit trial courts, the criminal defendants, and especially jurors. So the first prong of Williams is relevance, Rule 401. And this court's Curry decision discussed how other acts evidence should be reasonably near to the offense at hand. I think no one will dispute that 30 years is not reasonably near. Here, the acquittal evidence was from a 1986 case in which the defendant was accused of inappropriately touching his own daughter and was acquitted.
Counsel, was the jury informed that he was acquitted of those charges?
Yes. The jury was put on notice early and often about the prior case and the acquittal. It first came up as early as voir dire, and then the prosecution in opening statement brought up the prior case in a way that was highly damaging. They said, this case seems to come down to a little girl's word against a grown man's word.
Okay. Let me stop you there. Sure. Here's my bit of confusion about your argument. On the one hand, your proposition talks about a bright line. You know, if there's a prior acquittal, yes, that should be barred. And yet we're talking about the facts. So if we're talking about the facts, that's not a bright line. So help me understand specifically what your argument is,
sure,
and do we even need to discuss the facts in this case?
So the facts of the case, as far as the bright line, the complete bar is concerned, that is only relevant to the constitutional issue.
Well, and I'll stop you there.
Sure.
I have a subpart question.
Okay.
Are we talking about the Ohio Constitution, or are we only talking about the U.S. Constitution?
Necessarily, Dowling contemplates both, but our request for relief asks that you afford greater rights under the Ohio Constitution.
And did you raise that below?
Yes. So the issue was first raised in the motion in limine filed by defense counsel prior to both trials said something to the effect that the evidence should be excluded on the grounds that it is barred by the Ohio Rules of Evidence and under the Ohio and U.S. Constitutions.
And was that raised to the Court of Appeals as an assignment of error?
So, the first assignment of error referenced the Dowling case in particular, and then prior counsel puts the citations to the Ohio and federal constitutions right in the assignment of error, the text of it.
Okay. So we're talking about both the Ohio and the federal constitution. So
yes.
I'll go back to the first part of my question then. Are we arguing about the facts of this case, or are you asking for a complete bar?
So the first proposition of law asks for the complete bar, yes. That is really the only proposition where the acquittal is relevant. The second proposition of law focuses on the Williams test. And that does bring in some factual considerations to demonstrate why, particularly the third prong, the prejudice prong, but still some universal principles. So like I was getting to say, the age of the evidence is relevant only to the first principle. The Curry decision is kind of ignored, even though that reasonably near language appears in it. The second prong really is not evidence specific, the 404B prong of Williams. We are asking this court actually follow what the federal courts already require. As the U.S. versus Merriweather case that we cited as additional authority noted, the Sixth Circuit, that the federal courts already do this. They require the narrowing by the proponent, and then the assessment by the trial court is the evidence probative of those particular exceptions. And then they require that the judge instruct the jury just as to those exceptions. And if you think about it,
Yes. But if we require that, say we require that going forward, we haven't announced that before.
Right.
That wouldn't be a reason to reverse this decision, would it?
Correct, Your Honor. In this case, even if this court declines to, bar acquittal evidence outright, and even if this court declines to rein in Williams, still in this case, especially with the absence of a 403 analysis, which appears nowhere on the record.
Well, but on the facts of this case, though, I get that there was some kind of loose language, but how is this not relevant in this case to accident, which he seemed clearly to be arguing that this was an accident, that he didn't intend to do this and he was just rubbing baby oil on this child?
Yes, so that is the most tempting 404B exception because of the word accident. However, in the 404B sense, for that to be relevant or probative of lack of mistake or accident in this case, the prior acts would have to be akin to that. So there were no allegations that in the past he had been rubbing his daughter with oil and then it led to inappropriate touching. There was nothing like that. So in the current case, bring it forward to this matter, having the allegations springing forth from this practice of rubbing itchy skin is nowhere near the prior allegations, the prior act. The prior act is not probative of that actual exception.
Well, doesn't the prior act suggest that he had some purpose other than rubbing baby oil on him? Isn't that pretty probative? If he's abused children before, it's pretty probative that his motive is not just to apply ointment, right?
There still is the preponderance standard, so it's still have to determine that the act occurred and he was the perpetrator, but even so, that is still a leap. You know, to reach that conclusion, you have to fall into the propensity trap. And especially in these kinds of cases, 404B evidence is particularly dangerous. And this case is textbook for that.
But isn't that why you have instructions?
It is, but it is our position that the instructions, untailored for the average layperson, are not meaningful. And in part, that is why the federal courts, when lay people hear this long list, and it bears mentioning that at trial itself, the judge, when the limiting instructions were issued, the judge said, you are going to hear evidence admissible for a particular purpose, and then didn't elaborate, and then went on to say it may not be used for propensity. So the jury got nothing there.
What may not be used for propensity?
I don't remember the particular purposes, but it was a propensity language afterward. It may not be used to prove action and conformity or something.
Pardon me?
The court said something to the effect of, this evidence is coming in for a limited purpose. Stop.
Not to show propensity.
Yes, or action and conformity, but that's not the part I was wishing to focus on. The part
I'm focusing on it because he instructed the members of the jury,
yes,
who speak English, and presumably, if they didn't understand, could have asked.
Yes.
Okay.
But were given no, what is that limited purpose? They were giving nothing. And the state was allowed then to present, This case, the way the state presented the case was textbook for how to make someone look like a child molester. They brought this stuff up in voir dire and opening. They put on the prosecuting witness from 86 first. They put on her sister second. And then the limiting instructions gave the jury no reason to think about this evidence in what specific way. Limited purpose means nothing to the laypeople.
Counsel, didn't this limiting instruction come right after a rebuttal argument from the state in which they referenced the earlier acquittal, not with details about the MO, the modus operandi, but just simply an argument that the jury got it wrong. The prosecutor said, I've been doing this for a long time. I can tell you that number of jury trials where a jury must, like yourself, have come back and said not guilty, just because a jury says not guilty doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Precisely, yes. So that was part of the latter part of that textbook chapter is discrediting. That was actually, yes, in closing, rebuttal closing. And the prosecution, after the defense got up and tried to defend against this theme, said, this is frustrating. They don't always acquit because they're innocent. And so they, in effect, just strongly discounted the acquittal aspect of that evidence anyway. And that was the last thing the jury heard. So the way that this entire case...
They also heard from the prosecuting witness in the first case who insisted in three different formats, this is what happened to her by this individual. Correct?
Correct.
Just like the first jury did, who acquitted the defendant.
Correct, and that was an important point that the first jury, in the 86 case, he was acquitted. Then when this case was first tried, the first jury hung. The second jury almost hung. They needed the Howard charge to proceed. The second jury still acquitted on two of the charges. So this was not one of those overwhelming evidence cases we hear about. The 404B evidence was pivotal. It was highly inflammatory. Again, to...
If he was acquitted on... What were the charges he was acquitted on in the second trial here?
In the second trial here, the rape charges.
Okay, the rape charges. So apparently the jury did understand what they were supposed to do and the instructions. They weren't... You're not arguing they were confused on that.
We can't necessarily make that leap. Sometimes juries, we know, take the split-the-baby approach. They say, oh, he probably should have been convicted back then, so we're going to dole out our own justice now, and we're going to split
they
the baby.
They acquitted him on two accounts, the serious accounts of rape.
Yes.
Okay, it seems to me that they took their job seriously.
I think they took their job seriously, too. It is not to denigrate their morals or ethics to say that even legal practitioners like lawyers and some trial court judges get 404B wrong. It's confusing. So to hear the laundry list of issues, and especially when you're given the limiting instruction, not giving any of those issues, just the bottom line is the federal practice is much cleaner, easier to follow, and focuses the jury's attention right from the start. And we advocate for that change today. It would not be hard to enforce. It would take some work on the front end. But that would be actually a good thing, because to apply 404B correctly, you have to understand it, really understand it. And that would be, I think, a tremendous benefit to our whole justice system and defendants, and especially jurors. On this record as well, the 403 evidence is actually completely absent. We can only infer that it occurred because the evidence came in. That is problematic because, especially in child sex abuse cases, the unfair prejudice, the prejudice is there. It's already there. The unfair prejudice, though, Creech is a prior decision cited in our briefs where this court said that probative value must be discounted where there is other evidence available. In this case, we had the victim, R.E., testified. We had the PSANE nurse testify. We had the lead detective testify. Actually, two detectives testify. So necessarily, the probative value of the other acts evidence should have been reduced. And when you do look at the egregious prejudice occasioned by this evidence, it should have been excluded. The problem is this court, the Court of Appeals, cannot do a meaningful 403 review. There's nothing to review on the record. And the 403 analysis being critical, the defendant, since abuse of discretion is the standard, the defendant is almost given no review in a case where there's no 403 findings on the record at all. This court also explained in Creech that unfair prejudice is that which arouses the jury's sympathies, evokes a sense of horror, or appeals to the instinct to punish. And the unfair prejudice of the 30-year-old other acts evidence in this case, it was designed to do just that. So if anything, again, all three Williams prongs could stand to be revisited, but especially that second prong, we would ask that this court mimic what the federal courts do and require that the proponent provide those actual specific exceptions, and then the trial court, after doing the analysis, instruct the jury accordingly.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Heenan.
Good morning. May it please the court. This talk of revising how we instruct juries would have been a great thing to raise for the first time in the trial court, but it was not. At no point did they say object to the instructions that were given. Instead, they were the instructions that they asked for that were given. Neither during trial nor during the jury instruction phase were the instructions that were given objected to. At no point below did Mr. Smith say, hey, we need to be a little bit more specific. We need to make things more clear for the jury. That did not happen. If we have a case where that does happen, that might be a very interesting issue for this court to tackle.
Is there any reason we shouldn't say going forward that trial courts, the best practice is to make these kind of findings and to have specific instructions like the federal courts do?
Well, if that was the issue that had been raised below and argued all the way up to here, then that might be something to consider, but it was not. And that's not something that, again, if it had been brought up below, then yes, I think that might be an interesting question for this court.
It's pretty hard to review these cases when there's no, when there really aren't explicit findings in the trial court on the 404 and 403 factors, when the court's less than clear about and counsel's less than clear about what it's what the specific exception is. I mean, would the state have any problem with that if we said going forward courts should do this?
Well, the issue of doing that in this case is that we were specific. The state was specific during the 404B hearings before trial. We said we would be offering evidence to show a common scheme and a lack of mistake or accident. We focused down.
Okay, I guess that's part of my concern, because clearly it doesn't come in for a common scheme. I mean, it doesn't come close to meeting the test, and we don't really know why the trial judge allowed in, whether it was accident, which seems a much better argument than a common scheme. But there's very little on the record about that.
I would disagree with you on the common scheme. If you actually look at this, if this had just been a general grooming case where, you know, the evidence showed he groomed this child, then sure, that would not be.
You can disagree, but I'm going to have a hard time finding a common scheme that's goes 30 years. I mean, this just sounds like propensity evidence.
I disagree. The evidence showed that every time he did this, he made sure that someone else was home. Every time he did this, he showed porn to the child. Every time he did this, he brought up the victim's mother. And these are things that are unique to this case, unique to his behavioral fingerprint. And that is why it would be the common scheme.
Right, and a behavioral fingerprint is relevant when identity is at issue. Identity is not at issue in this case.
I would agree that identity was not at issue in this case.
Counsel, let's say for a moment, though, that we agree with Justice DeWine and say this seems to have been brought in for propensity. It shouldn't have come in. Do you have a fallback position? As I understand it, there was some additional evidence that came in. How do we tell whether the jury was relying on the evidence that maybe should or shouldn't have come in and not this other evidence that also came in of the other witnesses?
What we have, as the Chief Justice pointed out, we have the verdicts that show that they were still able to discern what they felt did and did not happen and were willing to acquit him on things that they felt he did not do. Additionally, I mean, just when you look at the evidence as a whole, you have the child's story, you have everything that she said that was consistent not only with what she testified to trial, but what she told everybody about what had happened. Every time she spoke, her story was consistent. I think the only thing that was wrong was, I think, what clothes were being worn at the time. I mean, it was a minor detail, but the details that mattered, she was always consistent on. So even if you take the past away, you still have the evidence that would support this conviction.
But don't you also look at the defense for Mr. Smith, which was inadvertence or mistake or accident? I mean, he said, I was only rubbing oil on her, and if something inappropriate happened, it was by accident.
And then we go back to the, as Justice DeWine pointed out, that there's clearly 404B evidence that would refute the accident claim
here.
I'm
looking at 404B. That's why I mentioned the accident or mistake, which is his defense.
That is his defense. And I think when you bring in an accident defense, that clearly opens the door for 404B evidence to come in. And again, if we want to give more explicit instructions, then we should be objecting to those instructions below, and that did not happen here. So I just don't see how that issue is before us today.
And so I'm still getting kind of hung up on the distinction between Prop 1 and Prop 2. You know, Prop 2 is factual. Prop 2 is asking us potentially to correct an error at the trial court. So help me understand Prop 1. Are we talking about both the Ohio Constitution and the U.S. Constitution in your view?
I think we are, because we have the double jeopardy clause. We've said that they're coextensive, that they exist together, and this court has repeatedly been guided by federal decisions on that when it's come up with its double jeopardy jurisprudence. You're not controlled by what the feds have done. Obviously, as has been pointed out repeatedly in the briefs, you can go beyond what the feds have done, but so far we haven't done that.
Well, let me clarify. So if we have two issues, one is it unconstitutional under the Ohio Constitution? The second is it unconstitutional under the U.S.? We are bound by Dowling, by the U.S. Supreme Court, when it comes to interpreting what the U.S. Constitution requires.
Yes.
So in that respect, we're going to stick with what the U.S. Supreme Court has told us. And in your view, is there any room for us to go outside of what Dowling has told us?
I believe that Dowling sets the floor. We can't go below Dowling. We can't do that. But you can obviously, if the court wants to, it can give more protections than the federal courts have. However, that would be kind of an awkward result, given this court's State versus Craig decision, where in 2006, it said that similar 404B evidence, when there was an ignore by a grand jury, was admissible. And when it cited Dowling in that, it actually, in the parenthetical, point out that Dowling says that evidence of an acquittal may be used in 404B evidence. Going back even further than that, in Patterson, over a century ago, we'd have to have that case be reversed too. Now, I recognize that that was before 404B and the equivalent revised code section was in place. So it obviously at this point is guiding and not necessarily binding, but it's certainly pointing us in the direction that Dowling ended up coming to and that Craig came to, which is that this evidence is admissible. Now, if that's the finding, then the second proposition in the law is asking you to do nothing but review what the first district did. At that point, I think it was improvidently granted, and that shouldn't be before this court. If you were, however, to completely change the way we've been looking at 404B evidence all this time, then the second proposition of law comes into effect. But at that point, I think if you change things that dramatically, because it would require essentially reversing Patterson and Craig, if that were to happen, then I think the appropriate result would be for this to be sent back to the first district to apply whatever law this court would give. And of course, obviously, I think that we should affirm what happened below and that this court's history shows that that is the right result. Briefly, I do want to address the additional authority that was brought up. The West Virginia, the Nebraska versus Sanchez case, the U.S. versus Meriwether, that all goes to whether or not the jury instructions need to be given in a more specific manner. And again, the instructions that were given here were not objected to below. They were given at the defense request. The only other of these cases that were citing the additional authority that really seems to apply would be Hernandez, and that was going to the behavioral fingerprint that Judge Justice DeWine was speaking about. And I feel that that might have made a good assignment of error in the Court of Appeals. It would have been a good argument to raise below. But again, the way this court, or the way this case has come to this court, the procedural posture just does not put us in a position to review those instructions because there was no objection below, and it's really being talked about for the first time here. And I think it's notable that, I mean, that case came out the end of last year, but this case, which most people should be able to know about, was not even referenced. Beyond that, the additional authority, I mean, generally it's saying things like I said, this court can obviously go beyond what the U.S. Supreme Court has done in Dowling, but so far, every chance it's had to do that, it hasn't, and that's true of the other appellate courts as well.
We've said in Craig that, in essence, that we agree with Dowling, and the provisions of the U.S. Constitution and the Ohio Constitution are in sync.
Correct.
In their interpretation, as contained in Dowling, or in Craig via Dowling.
Correct. Correct. And that's why I said if to go with Mr. Smith's arguments in the first proposition of law would require this court to essentially overrule Patterson, Craig, and to say, Dowling's great, but we're going to go our own direction, even though we haven't before. With that, unless the court has any specific questions, I'll turn things over to the Attorney General, who had a few things to talk about regarding the Constitution. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Peterson.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I'd like to begin with Justice French. You had asked some questions about what is actually before the court and what's the relationship between these two props of law. I'd like to begin with the first proposition of law, because the prop only refers to the Ohio Constitution. It does not raise a U.S. constitutional claim. But the court should not consider that claim because it wasn't raised in the court below. Now, Mr. Smith said he included a citation to the Ohio Constitution at the end of his proposition of law in the lower court, but that's all that appeared. There was no discussion, there was no analysis, there wasn't even a complete sentence. It was just a token reference to the Ohio Constitution. And that is simply not sufficient to preserve any argument based on the Ohio Constitution. Now, we think that if the court does address the Ohio Constitution, it should hold that the Ohio Constitution provides no greater protection, and in fact, likely provides less protection than the U.S. Constitution does. But again, we think that has been forfeited. And then briefly, with respect to the second prop, the 404B prop, you know, this may have been a close call for the trial court on whether to admit this evidence. But what we haven't heard about today is the standard of review, the abuse of discretion. And that standard of review makes what is a tough call for a trial court an easy call for a court of appeals. And it would have to be unreasonable, arbitrary, or unconscionable, such that no conscientious judge could admit the evidence. And while,
I mean, and I think that's probably right about the weighing part of it, but if we don't think this is really evidence of accident or intent, then I don't think it gets to an abuse of discretion standard, does it?
Well, I think
you get to make the initial decision about what this evidence is introduced for.
I would disagree, Your Honor, because as Mr. Heenan did say, the prosecutor made clear both at the January 23rd and the March 22nd 404B hearing the specific reasons they were being introduced.
Right, but if we think that those specific reasons are just propensity, then
I think that would still, the trial judge made a different decision, and whether that decision
So we defer to legal decisions made by the trial court judges?
I think it's an evidentiary decision as to whether those the evidence does indeed fulfill those purposes, and it is subject to an abuse of discretion review.
So you think a legal decision about evidence is subject to an abuse of discretion standard?
I think that in this case, the decision whether to admit evidence and whether it has satisfied the evidentiary rules is reviewed for an abuse of discretion, yes. What we haven't heard today is any discussion of abuse of discretion. And even though Mr. Smith has raised a proposition of law that is essentially requesting the court to revisit, because as we even heard today, he conceded that is not asking for a bright line rule with respect to the second proposition of law, that it's only with respect to the constitutional provision. And so essentially, Mr. Smith has conceded that he is only seeking error correction here today. But with respect to that constitutional provision, if the court does address the Ohio Constitution, if it chooses to overlook the forfeiture in the lower court, we think that the court should hold that the Ohio Constitution provides no greater protection than the U.S. Constitution and likely provides less. And we look to the language, the history, and the early understanding of the Ohio Constitution, and all three point in the same direction. Begin with the language. The Double Jeopardy Clause of the Ohio Constitution speaks of being twice placed in jeopardy for the same offense, not the same evidence. But yet that is what Mr. Smith's argument would be all about. It would be placed twice in jeopardy for the same evidence. And then the history. The Ohio Constitution's Double Jeopardy Clause finds its roots in the common law plea of autrefois acquit and autrefois convict. And at the common law, these pleas did not deal with evidence. There was no collateral estoppel element like that recognized in Ashe to those common law pleas. As Matthew Hale said in the history of the pleas of the crown, a man could be acquitted of stealing a horse, yet convicted of stealing the saddle that sat upon that horse, even though both occurred at the same time. And that shows that even though there's a common element of fact, at common law, and this is the common law history of the Ohio Constitution, there would be no barrier to the introduction of that type of evidence. And finally, the early understanding of the Ohio Constitution. And Mr. Heenan spoke about the State v. Patterson case. And in 1917, the Ohio Constitution was so well understood to not bar the type of evidence that Mr. Smith is discussing here today, that the defendant didn't even raise the Double Jeopardy Clause of the Ohio Constitution, that he conceded the Double Jeopardy Clause of the Ohio Constitution did not apply. And that's what we haven't heard today from Mr. Smith about anything with respect to the Ohio Constitution. There's been no discussion of its history, its language. You've heard that the court can provide greater protection under the Ohio Constitution, that it can interpret it differently, but there's been no discussion of why it should. And because for that reason, and because the trial court did not abuse its discretion with respect to its 404B ruling, we would ask you to affirm the decision of the First District.
Thank you for answering my questions.
You're welcome.
Thank you, counsel. You've used your time. I'll give you a minute.
Defense counsel in this case raised the 404B issue, 403 issues pre-trial. They objected twice at trial, and then did ask for the limiting instruction with the law and its state does accord. What more is counsel supposed to do to preserve the error?
Did you object to the instructions?
They did.
Or the counsel object to the instructions?
Counsel did not, but the 404B and 403 were clearly preserved. And to require counsel to preserve every error with exquisite precision elevates form over function in a way that a lot of errors are going to be deemed waived. And I believe that would result
in... instructions is a pretty usual territory for objections and review on appeal.
Yes, but the instruction is one facet of this 404B, 403. That is the end issue. The rest of the 404 and 403 were preserved in the ways that counsel was supposed to. If this court does adopt Dowling, then that is all the more reason why the Ohio rules of evidence need to be doing their job. That is actually what the Dowling court noted, that there are non-constitutional protections in place to make sure that there is a fair trial, i.e. the federal rules of evidence. So if you reject our Prop 1, that makes Prop 2 all the more important and not error correction. This will apply to every trial court in this state. And that is why we're here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, we call a recess.